Harry. Harry!
What?
It's an inanimate fucking object.
You're an inanimate fucking object!
And Awe, the double feature podcast that celebrates all movies from the sublime to the suspicious. I'm Lindsay Wilkins, and today it's all going to be acting with the eyebrows. Yep, it's a Colin Farrell double with 2011's remake of Fright Night and 2008's In Bruges. And with me, I have one of the biggest Colin Farrell fans. You most likely heard him on the likes of Inside the Sequel and, of course, Cobwebs, and he has his own YouTube channel, Nathan Jones, because it is the one and only Nathan Jones. Hey, how's it going?
I'm good. How are you?
I am really well. Thank you so much for coming on and suggesting this Colin Farrell double. I'm kind of surprised he hasn't shown up before on the show yet.
Well, I'm glad that you brought up eyebrows, because he is honestly, everything he does, he can just tell with his eyebrows. And he can, like, I guess he could do, you know how like The Rock has his one eyebrow raise, but he can move his inverted and side to side. And it's enchanting.
It really is. Never has an actor done so much with his eyebrows. It's kind of insane. In every single movie, they do a different thing, from Killing of a Sacred Deer, where they do a thing, to, well, we'll get into In Bruges, where he's doing very specific things with his raising of his eyebrows and his face, essentially. Oh my God, that shrug. So he's a really amazing actor, and kind of one that kind of will not be typecast, because he's a working actor who likes to do everything.
Right.
Just to put you on the spot, do you have some other favorite Colin Firth performances?
So the Colin Farrell performances that I like, I mean, you did bring up Killing of a Sacred Deer, and so I obviously like The Lobster too, both Yorgos films, which I think are quite, like, I guess, in the maybe more Kubrick-esque, like a little bit more cold, and but also like The Lobster is a comedy, so it's I don't know, he's good in comedic roles, so those movies I really, really like. Some of his more recent releases, there's a little Irish film called Onadine. It's like a romance, like kind of fairy tale film that I really like with him in it. He's been in a lot of other Martin McDonagh things that we brought up. We're going to talk about In Bruges, but he also did the next film that Martin McDonagh would do, which is Seven Psychopaths, which I also enjoy quite a bit. Even in the movies that he's not great in per se, like Alexander, for instance, I will still watch those movies because of him.
I actually need to give Alexander another try. I think that's the only movie I've ever walked out of. We were the group, very snobby university students who were studying a little bit of classical history, I guess. And that movie just confused the hell out of me. Time you going back to like the fourth flashback, we were just looking at each other going, what is happening? What is Oliver Stone doing?
Right. It's a very confusing movie. Even the director's cut's not even, like, it's very confusing in that regard too. So
I definitely need to try that, watch that movie again, because I was just like, I just remember myself as a very early 20s person going, I don't get it. Why are we flashing back again? You serious? Which now I know is very Oliver Stone, but at the time I didn't get it.
Yeah, Oliver Stone's hit and miss, you know. There's a few movies that I think he does very, very well, like something like JFK. And then some that are a little bit, maybe not so much my thing. So like, what was that one that Tarantino wrote that I'm blanking on right
now? Oh, Natural Born Killers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That might not be my thing, but oh, it could be that, other people's things.
That is a trip of a movie that you have to be on the exact same trip with, I think, Natural Born Killers. Yeah. Yeah. When I kind of realized he's making two movies at the same time, I kind of got in a little bit more, but it helped that I was also doing it for this podcast. And I went, right, I have to actually sit down and appreciate, kind of see all the things. I have to watch it in a different way than the first time I watched it, where I was just like, oh, God, don't stop being a dick.
Right.
No, I've always sort of enjoyed this kind of, either when he's doing like a big blockbuster one, like Daredevil, when he's being completely insane. Yeah.
That bullseye.
Bullseye.
Like that line of his name. It's an insane movie, but like it's fun, but it's bad.
Yes, that is the exact way I would try it. But I very much enjoyed Colin Farrell and also Miami Vice, which I know he does not remember making.
Right.
But and you don't know whether he's giving a really bad performance or an inspired performance. It's just one of those things where it's a magic movie. I love it. And I'm still looking at him going, you're high, but I don't know if this is making your performance better or worse within the context of the movie. It's one of those special kind of ones. He's definitely
It's so crazy that he's worked with so many directors. That he's I'm looking at the list now: Spielberg, Schumacher, Oliver Stone, Terrence Malick, Michael Mann, Woody Allen, Martin McDonagh, Terry Gilliam, like just Peter Weir. A few people. And this long list of people he's worked with.
Yeah, because he is a really great actor. And I love how Yorgos Lanthimos, I'm pretty butchering his name, keeps going back. The Greek name that I'm butchering, keeps going back and using him. I mean, he's only been in a couple of movies, but he's just the way that he knows how to use him, because he's kind of the actor that he needs to be in a role, but I think there's an innate warmth to him. And the fact that Yorgos makes these very cold movies, he knows how to use them essentially, because in both Killing of a Sacred Deer and in The Lobster, two completely different performances, but with the same tone, if that makes sense.
And just the way that he performs, I think, like you said, he has a warmth to him. So like thinking of a movie that came out not that long after Killing of a Sacred Deer, The Beguiled,
Sofia Coppola
one, which is great. Talk about a film where like obviously he is like a centerpiece of, obviously, because it's a part of the major plot line of the story. You know, he is someone that, you know, can literally has that flexibility as an actor. I feel like that he can bring a lot of energy, both good or bad, towards whatever end point he's looking for. And I like that. So
yeah, no, me too. I really love that a lot. And I think the double that we have kind of show both sides of that.
Right.
Yeah. Before we get into our actual double, I just want to ask you about your fantastic YouTube channel, which I have started just calling the Nathan Jones Show, even though that's not its name.
I should change it. I should just change it now.
Yes, I'm gonna you should.
Change it to the Nathan Jones Show and then put a little CC at the bottom, like name credited to Lindsay Wilkin.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes.
Oh, how is that show going?
The show is good. So my Nathan Jones YouTube channel, which it's called Nathan Jones for people looking for it. Or I'm sure you'll put it in the description or something.
Absolutely.
But yeah, no, it's a long way from, I started about 4 years ago now. And I started off as like a movie review channel, kind of in the heyday of when movie reviewers kind of were a big thing, and then wanted to join in on that. And it's kind of changed a little bit to more of a physical media presence. And I definitely focus on Blu-rays and boutique Blu-ray labels and a lot of collecting aspects. And I also talk about a lot of different like topics. So like I know earlier this year and late last year, I was talking a lot about minimalism a little bit and collecting fatigue. And there's just, I mean, obviously it's a roller coaster there and really open-ended, because I know everyone who watches has varying degrees of that. And then lately I've been doing a lot of challenges, because I have a lot of unwatched films on my shelf. I'm sure many people who buy physical media know this problem, And so I've just created some fun challenges. So the one that I did most recently is a Mad Lib syntax challenge, which is where you find five films and you have to try to make a sentence out of the titles.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so you are allowed like articles and connectives and things like that, make the sentence kind of coherent. But it's a lot of fun, because even if none of the movies have anything connecting to them whatsoever, it's fun to kind of just make a sentence out of the five movies that you picked and just watch movies that have been sitting on your shelf for a couple of years. So
that is absolutely perfect. Plus you can just kind of mix and match kind of whatever, well, not whatever you want, because you have to make the sentence, but you can get some kind of really wild movies together in one bunch, which of course I'm just a big fan of. No, that is an absolutely great, and it is a really great show, because you've also did a series on the history of film where you just go through every single decade. And that's been really great as well, because I think, especially for some of the older ones, people sort of don't always realize that the 30s are a freaking amazing time for film. Same with the 40s and the 50s. They're not as, especially when you get into the Hays Code era, they're not as squeaky clean as people think they are. It's just people were having to do a workaround of how they did certain themes, but they are absolutely there.
Yeah. And a lot of those writers, a lot of the writers did a lot of the work, but I would say, and directors too, and also actors. I guess I could just put everyone in there, but I feel like the writers, especially dealing with those codes, had a lot of creative boundary, or like, well, they had boundaries put in place from them, so their creative output was pushed to the limit. So I feel like you get better things because of that pressure, because it more or less forced them to be in a creative light and like have to go around it. In a way.
Yes, absolutely. And I kind of feel that way a little bit about In Bruges, once we'll get into it, just because you can tell this was a smaller production, literally sort of a small production, and it's all within the dialogue. They have to do things, not necessarily, well, some of the action, but it's a very dialogue heavy movie, as we will get into. But within that, we might as well get into our Colin Farrell Fest. Now, because this is Shock and Awe, we're sitting down and there are going to be trailers shown. So, Nathan, if we're going to be sitting down to Fright Night, what would be the first trailer you would show for Fright Night?
Well, I think the obvious trailer would probably be the original Fright Night from 1985.
Yes.
But I'm not going to go there, but I am going to go with a neighborhood horror / comedy, which is kind of what Fright Night is like too, but a little bit later. From the original, from 1989, I would play The Bird.
He said he thinks the Klopex are evil incarnate.
Well, you're much too smart to fall for that, aren't you, honey?
But now...
Carol!
You wouldn't want to visit there.
Ray, this is Walter.
No!
The Burbs.
I'm going over the fence, and I'm not coming back till I find a dead body.
Ray, do you want him to take your family, kidnap them, tear their livers out, and make some kind of satanic pate? Ah! We found Walter!
We got a real problem.
I hit the gas light, I'd run!
God, I love this street.
Yes. I love this movie. This movie's perfect. I'm assuming you love The Burbs as well?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, how could you not like Carrie Fisher, you know, Tom Hanks, Bruce Dern, even Corey Feldman around this, speaking of vampires, you know?
Yeah, absolutely perfect. No, this is kind of one of those it's perfect because it's sort of got that neighborhood paranoia, but with Satanists instead of vampires. But, you know, Satan is good. Satan is your pal. He's your friend, guys. They're good. And it's, no, this movie is kind of one of those perfect gems that I used to watch as a kid, but didn't realize how good it was until you watch it when you're older. And I'm like, holy shit. I keep saying this. It feels like a movie that Joe Dante got away with. And everyone sort of went, what? But it became a classic.
Right. I mean, and the thing is, like, I've been actually going through the Twilight Zone series.
Oh, wow. Yep.
Which I obviously watched as a kid, but like here and there with my dad. One of the more recent episodes I watched near, I think it's in season two, the monsters are due on Maple Street, which is like this suburban kind of paranoia, kind of playing in with the Cold War kind of elements that were definitely around this time period. But yeah, that totally plays into like what the Burbs would do later on.
I
like that connection.
No, that is a really, really great connection, and a perfect trailer, because it is, well, it's the Burbs. It's absolutely great. For my first trailer I'm going to share, I'm going to go for a Colin Farrell movie, and very different in tone, but kind of one that I thought fit, just because it is about a person being into an environment where he's all causing all kinds of issues. And that is Sofia Coppola's remake as well, of The Beguiled.
Miss Martha! Miss Martha!
Is he dead?
No, get him inside.
Quick!
You're our most unwelcome visitor, and we do not propose to entertain you.
You'll find them easily amused.
You won't be here long enough for that.
How did you end up in this place?
Why are you so interested in me?
I admire your strength.
I'm just trying to give them what they need to survive in these times.
If you could have anything in the world, what would it be?
To be taken far away from here.
Come with me.
Anyway, that is my trailer.
excellent choice.
Yes. Very different from the original. I don't know actually which is better, because I think, you know, how do you compare Don Siegel and Sofia Coppola? But I love Colin Farrell in this movie, mainly because he looks like, also in Fright Night, he looks like he just wants to eat everyone, which is the premise, if you have never seen The Beguiled. American Civil War soldier kind of ends up at this old plantation where it is just a school for women that have just kind of been sort of, I guess, left to their own devices to try and survive. And he kind of enters it, and then all kinds of issues erupt from it. But because it's Sofia Coppola, it is very gauzy and very kind of natural lighting kind of movie. But yeah, then you've just got these, but again, Colin Farrell at the center of it, not knowing exactly what kind of havoc he's causing. But it is a great, great movie. And he is great. Again, if you want to talk about eyebrow acting, he has got that in space in this movie.
Yeah, I know you mentioned gauzy, so like just in the atmosphere of the but like that, it, I mean, just his you'll need gauze for his eyebrow action. Just to, you know, mop up all that sweat.
Yes, you really do. It is a very sweaty movie, in more ways than one. But no, I really, the more, every time I watch a Sofia Coppola movie, I'm never entirely sure how I feel about it until about 3 years after I've seen it. So I'm at the stage where I'm just like, you know, I like The Beguiled. I like The Beguiled. I don't know. It always takes me a little while to come around on her movies.
Yeah, honest. That's a good point, because I feel like I've only seen The Beguiled, I want to say 1.5 or 2 times. And I definitely, and it was around the time that it came out. And yeah. I would say only until really relatively recently, obviously it's 4 years old now, but have I kind of remembered being like, you know what, actually that's a movie I still think about, which is a good sign, because that means that I'm, you know, it was effective, obviously. And so I'm due for a rewatch.
No, me too. Cause even though I've only seen it once and it was when it came out, it's still a movie that I still just sometimes randomly think about, which I think is a really good sign. And usually what happens with a Sofia Coppola movie with me, I walk out of the theater my first watch going, no, I don't know about that. And then 3 years later, I'm like thinking back and no, I think I actually did like that movie. I think it was really well done. It sits with you.
Right. I mean, yeah. I mean, everyone involved in that, not just Colin Farrell.
Oh.
Just Nicole Kidman in particular, right? I'm just, you can't unforget that. Is that a word? Unforget?
Unforget. No.
No. It's not a word.
No, but it is kind of unforgettable. She is great in that. Same with Kirsten Dunst and even Elle Fanning. They are all amazing performances in this. And yeah, it is just an incredible thing to watch. Again, unforgettable, those performances. Nathan, what would your, if you were going to show a second trailer, what would it be for Fright Night?
Since we're just thinking about one, so I might as well just put a Colin Farrell one with it as well. If we're talking about Fright Night, that, which is a fantasy film, let's talk, I like the direction you talked about with The Beguiled, and talking about a gauzy atmospheric film, a one that I feel like isn't talked about too often, which I think is actually quite underrated, would be The New World, the Terrence Malick film.
We I've always believed that something good was in store for me. Destiny all my own.
Definitely an otherworldly film that, like, obviously is set in, I mean, Terrence Malick kind of just makes everything, even if it is reality, otherworldly.
Yes, he does.
In a way, with just how he shoots a film. So, yeah, that's what I'd put is The New World.
Oh, that is absolutely perfect. I think I'm mixing with another Terrence Malick movie. I've only seen a handful, so I haven't really yet. I've got to explore his, especially his later output. But no, that is absolutely a great trailer. And I love the dreaminess of it because right now it's actually kind of not, it's kind of dreamy in a way, just because of the way of the performances, I guess. But since we are going for a second trailer, I am going to throw in a movie that with the other actors, specifically Anton Yelchin and Imogen Poots. And one of the most intense movies ever made, I'm going Green Room from 2015.
Ooh. You're trash. Things have gone south. It won't end well.
You can't keep us here, man. You gotta let us go.
We're not keeping you. You're just staying.
Shoot who is left.
Let him bleed.
Get ready to run.
Here we go.
Careful now.
Yeah, another movie I've only seen once, and I'm leaving Tyler Schreff if I ever want to watch again.
Patrick, what have you done?
Yes.
You used to be so kind.
I know. I'm just watching it. I think that's the thing. If I think if it wasn't Patrick Stewart playing the Nazi, I think I would be fine with it. But I'm just like, no, what are you? No, Patrick, stop. No.
What are you doing?
it's a brilliant movie though. It is so intense and you feel every single moment of violence. You feel every single moment of fear. You, every single time Patrick Stewart's on screen, you want to cry. Cause you're like, I'm sorry. What has just happened? But he's so good in it that it is amazing. So yes.
Yeah. And I love that director. I mean, I haven't seen his latest output. Jeremy Saulnier,
yes,
is his name.
Yeah,
I really like Blue Ruin, which is the movie he did previously to Green Room. I guess I've only seen two of his four films, so. Yeah. But I liked what I've seen, and even if it's intense as hell, which is what Green Room is.
Oh yeah, I've seen Green Room and the one he did afterward, which I'm kind of like but didn't love. But I need to go see
Blue Ruin.
Yeah, The Dark. Yeah. I was a little disappointed there wasn't a color in the title, but that's just me.
Right? I mean, come on, red's next, clearly.
Red is next. Red has to be next. And with that, we are going to get into the remake of Fright Night from 2011.
All right, kids aren't coming to school. It happens all the time.
I don't know if you're paying attention to roll call, but he's not the only one that's gone.
You're nuts.
This is my son, Charlie, and his girlfriend.
Hi.
So Jerry is our new neighbor.
Hey.
Hey.
Now listen to me. We graphed up all the disappearances. That's you right there in the center next to his house.
I really hate to be the one to tell you this, but that guy, your neighbor?
Jerry.
Yeah, he's a vampire.
That is a terrible vampire name. Jerry?
I've been watching you. Your mom, there's a kind of neglect, gives off a scent. And your girl, she's ripe. It's on you to look out for them, because there are a lot of bad people out there, Charlie.
Now, as we were talking off mic, you've said you've seen this a couple of times before, or this was your first time since your first, this was your first time since your first watch back in the day. Do you remember what your first reaction to Fright Night was?
Back in the day, this was kind of near the end of a lot of the home media, like Blockbuster days. Maybe Blockbuster was gone by this point, but there was definitely around my area still a few stores that you could do movie rentals and whatnot. But I do remember renting this movie. I think I was working at a grocery store at the time, which had a movie rental thing connected to it, which was really great. I think I just took this home one night and just watched it and thought it was a lot of fun, but you know, nothing I'd buy at the time. And I had not at this point had not seen the 1985 Friday Night, by the way. So I had no idea there was a original movie that came previously to this one. So back in 2011, this is back when I'm just discovering Marvel films, probably, and really just kind of going in different directions with like maybe Tarantino and Michael Mann and a lot of just figuring out things at this time. So this one was just a fun popcorn film from what I remember back in my time with this one.
Popcorn movie is a good way of putting this, even though I think there are some amazing set pieces in this movie that really actually surprised me. I think a really good strong popcorn movie is kind of a good way of describing it, because I missed it. I only saw the original a couple of years ago, and then of course watching Fright Night for this. But I do remember the sort of talk around it as most 80s or most horror movies go, there's usually a following. And I know people, there was a thing of like, why would you want to make Fright Night? It's a perfect movie. Mm-hmm. And that kind of thing where every time there's a horror remake come out, it's like, oh no, but the original's
like don't touch it.
Don't touch it. What are you doing?
But money.
Yes, but money. And it's yes, they're always going to be remaking certain things. And technically, Fright Night is a weird remake of Rear Window. So but it's one of those movies that's always kind of held up in self-esteem by a very kind of a smaller community. Once you realize, go out of your bubble, and then you realize most people don't even haven't heard of the original Fright Night. But it is kind of, I do enjoy the original. I don't have the history with it. I don't as love it as much as some other people, but you can see how really strong it is, especially with the whole coming of age, vampire, sexual awakening with the vampire kind of thing. And, you know, having Chris Sarandon as a sweater wearing vampire is kind of a genius choice of casting. Mm-hmm. And I can kind of see why they went with Colin Farrell, because you need someone, and especially the way Farrell plays it, I think having the fact that he's a particularly handsome man, I think works in his favor.
I saw the way Toni Collette looked at him.
Oh, yeah. I mean, seriously, as soon as she sees him, she's like, well, hello, which is understandable.
Well, hello. Because yeah, it's understandable.
It's Colin Farrell. And I like how he kind of uses his handsomeness, because I think Chris Sarandon uses his charm more than anything else. And you can't help going, yes, but Colin Farrell is pure good looks. And I love the fact that in this movie, he's pure evil in this movie. I mean, I don't think he's not actually particularly that, he is charming only because he's good looking, if that makes sense. When you actually speak to him for 2 seconds, you realize that, oh God, this guy's
okay, something's monster. Off with this guy.
Yeah. And I like how he makes that choice of like, no, I'm already a good looking man. I don't need to keep trying to get people into my house. I can just kind of raise an eyebrow and they're in. And then they're like, oh no, what have I done? Whereas Chris Sarandon was much more charming.
I would definitely say that's the truth. Yeah. A lot more charming.
Yeah, because that was kind of the notion of the movie, and you kind of want to, and especially because in the movie you need to understand why Charlie's girlfriend, I'm blanking on her name, actually does go with him. You need to understand that, but with this movie it's much more kind of violent and much more visceral, which I kind of appreciated the change in that they didn't try and make Colin Farrell the most charming man in the world.
No, and I will say, I mean, obviously we're jumping a little bit into the movie, but I will say the like pretty much the cut to where like everyone believes, you know, Brewster was very, very fast, because I feel like that switch over to like he's a vampire and then like running into his girlfriend Amy and then his mom Jane, and he was like, what are you talking about? Like, or you know, I was like, what do you mean? And then he like rips out the power. I'm like, oh, that's what's up. Got it. And so he is bad. Like it was less of a, you know, that charming, you know, from the original, you'd get that maybe like, you still have like a, well, we know as the audience, obviously Brewster knows, but not everyone else knows. And I feel like I wanted a little bit more setup, a little bit more, more character interactions where he was a little bit more suave. Yeah.
This is not a movie that believes in the slow burn at all.
No,
because we might as well go back to the beginning. I tend to jump around a lot. So,
I do that too.
We meet, there's definitely different things between the two, because when you talk about Fright Night, the original is always going to be in sort of everyone, the back of everyone's mind. This is not about a guy who wants to have sex. This is not about a kid. This is about a kid that's growing up, but this is about a kid who wants a Charlie that wants to be popular. And now he has the prettiest girl in school as his girlfriend. And he's kind of jumped into a new clique and left his friend Evil Ed, played by Christopher Mintz-Platz, kind of behind. And it is kind of about that thing of, I don't necessarily think that through line works as well as the original does, as about a kid who maybe wants to move a bit faster than his girlfriend, is this coming of age, using Christopher Randon is almost like this kind of sexual role model, which I think becomes a little way more icky and complicated in the original, and it works. This is much more of a straightforward of, oh, I want to be cool and hang out with Dave Franco kind of thing. But in saying that, I do love Anton Yelchin's performance, just because I love generally him in everything that I've seen him in.
Right.
Like one of those actors taken too soon, because you just watch him going, oh, he's just really good.
Yeah, and even in movies that aren't so great, he's definitely one of the centerpieces of almost everything he's in.
Yeah, so, like Fright Night. And just the kind of the way you can kind of see him going, oh, I want to make, trying not to care about his old friends and trying to present himself in a very specific way to Imogen Poots and to the new clique around him was really, really well done. But you're right, there is kind of, I don't know, no, I kind of like the fact the movie just went, you know what? He's an evil vampire. He's just going out and eating. He's a shark. There's no kind of other thoughts kind of around him. There's no mystique. There's just this, because this movie goes far more brutal than I thought a popcorn movie of this nature would. And it's especially the turning scene of Christopher Mintz-Platz as Evil Ed, and the scene with when you go in and Charlie Brewster's kind of figuring all this out, and then he goes into his house and finds his neighbor locked in the basement.
Yeah. I definitely would have to agree with you on the viciousness that Jerry the vampire.
Yes, Jerry the vampire.
Jerry the vampire, Colin Farrell's character, at least in this one. I think, you know, that you do bring up a good point. I think a lot of the people who maybe are watching this probably are aware of the original, obviously. Mm. And so I think maybe they cut out some of that exposition, mainly because it's like, we already know this, like it, and it is really, I mean, the same characters and everything. So yeah. Obviously it's a different take on it. And so I think they just went straight for the neck. So if you will.
Oh, they absolutely did. Because at the start of the movie, Evil Ed is already cotton on to the fact that there's a vampire in the neighborhood, and there's already someone who has, it starts off with a murder scene. Someone's already been killed. And it sort of, it really starts from the fact of, oh no, this is a vampire. There is absolutely no question about it. He is going around and he is literally biting people in the neck, drinking their blood, turning people. And it's kind of, the characters and the audience kind of have to suddenly catch up, because you are not kind of, there's no, oh, is he a vampire? Is Evil Ed or Charlie making this up? It's like, no, this is what he is. Everyone just needs to catch up, which is kind of why I do like Toni Collette's reaction when Colin Firth is in the backyard. And
like, what's he doing?
What's he doing? What?
what? He's grabbing the power cord. Oh crap, we gotta go. We need to get the car. Mom, get into the car. We gotta go.
We gotta go. Things are gonna blow up now, which they do. There's a sort of a sense that I was like, oh shit, there's not even gonna be any kind of warm up of, is he not a vampire? It's no, he's blowing up the house. Because it tries to set up the rules of what a vampire is and isn't very, very quickly, but I think it's slightly too rushed, because even I was forgetting of like, oh, so wait, crosses do work or don't work?
And they're weak sauce though.
Yeah, it's kind of, right, we need this rule now because this is what I need in the plot, not necessarily of like, oh, this is vampire lore. But in saying that, I do really like Farrell's performance because he is just going, you know what? I'm a shark. I'm a killer. It's kind of like feeling like I know there was a criticism like, oh, he's not really putting in anything, but I think he is because I think he's just realizing, no, I'm an asshole. So I will just play the ultimate asshole.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you definitely see that even more so when kind of, you know, like the next scene after the house is kind of blowing up when they're at David Tennant's, who's Peter Vincent's character, flat. Which of all, by the way, he's great as.
Oh, Peter. Yes.
He's one of the fun parts of this movie. He just totally is like, well, you know what? Everyone in this movie just said, fuck it. Let's just do it.
It really is. There's a definite fuck it attitude. And I remember sort of mentioning to a friend that, I'm watching Fright Night, the remake. She's like, all I remember of that movie is it with David Tennant with eyeliner. I'm like, and then I watched it. I went, that is actually kind of one of the more memorable parts. He's great. And I love Tennant. And he's got a let's fuck it. Let's do it attitude. And I know a lot of people were kind of annoyed that he was now a magician in Vegas, not a horror host.
Chris Angel type.
Yes, a Chris Angel type. And look, if you are going to set this thing in Vegas, which is kind of smart, again, transient population, easier to just pick people off without people noticing. A magician makes more sense in Vegas than it does, than I guess it does a horror host. But it's kind of got that big, but it gives Tennant this bombasticness to work with, which I like, because he's going for it in this movie, and I love it.
Like, you have alcohol around you, you have, just women at the, and drugs, and like, just do whatever you want, and here's your lingerie, so there you go.
Exactly. So. And the fact that the big portion of the movie, he is just walking around with his eyeliner and a silk robe and his underwear. It's an image and it works. He's actually, because David Tennant is really, really funny and he is kind of the comic relief a little bit in this. But it's just the moment when you just keep yelling at his girlfriend about getting packages and things. And they're like, wait, do you get packages this late? And he's like, No, I don't. Did I just invite someone in I shouldn't have?
No, Ginger, don't do it.
So there are some really kind of cute moments. And then I think it does devolve into a kind of an action movie of what was being made in 2011. But at the same time, you do get those little moments, especially with David Tennant, every single time he's in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it's great. Yeah, I like it.
Yeah. And also, I mean, I know we already talked about the trailers, but there's some things that like popped up in my head too. Like thinking about the setting again, like you were talking about like the production a little bit, makes me think a lot of Poltergeist in just like in the neighborhood, just in general, like when that first pan shot, kind of in this newly developed spot, I was like, oh, something bad's not going to happen there, is there? And that's something that I thought of, even though it's nothing like Poltergeist, but it's just the suburbs kind of thing that popped up in my head. And then when you brought up Rear Window, I also thought of Disturbia, you know, the Shia LaBeouf.
Yes.
Film, which is another Rear Window type film. So I guess this movie has a lot of cousins, but you know, this is more of the horror vein. So.
Yeah. And this is a movie that really leans into the horror vein. Because I think even Daniel Epler has said the original reminds him of a horror movie just because it's a slow burn. It's more about the pageantry, the setting, more than of the Gothic setting, more than anything else. And then you slowly get into the real horror. This movie starts off with straight away. This is not a movie that is going to wait for you to see if it's a horror movie. This is a horror movie off the bat. And when those violent moments hit, they do actually hit. I mean, I was actually kind of surprised at the moment when Bruce is trying to get his neighbor out of Jerry's house. And he's got little locked rooms in his basement where he can keep his victim so he can go feed on them more. And it's kind of a really, especially because you're mentioning the suburbs part. I mean, there's this amazing way that film has used the suburbs as this nice looking place, but often very dangerous. Like say Blue Velvet, like you never quite know what's happening in someone else's house. And this movie uses that to great effect because you've just got this normal neighborhood with neighbors. That, I mean, Toni Collette is kind of wish she'd stop playing mums, but at the same time, she's so good. She's so good at everything. I know. And in this movie, she's really great. With should have been kind of a nothing role, Colette turns it into something that has texture. I mean, again, we mentioned the part when Jerry's in the backyard pulling out the thing, but she's so good at like deciding, like, okay, you know what? No, I'm going to defend my son. I don't know exactly what he's done or what's going on. He's telling me something insane, but I need to believe him. And it's on her face. And you can kind of see her making those decisions of not letting Jerry in the house. And then her reaction to him in the backyard. It's kind of why she's Toni Collette and should be given all the awards. When I don't think it's written for there. Like, I like Imogen Poots. I just don't think she's given anything to do in this movie other than being a sad girlfriend and to victim at the end. But Toni Collette is just great.
Yeah, I think you brought up a good point where, you know, I think especially Toni Collette's character as the mom, is almost like a nothing role, but she does, even though she's not in it for very long, maybe probably a collective like 8 to 10 minutes of time that she's on the screen, period. I might be even like, you know, hyping that up more. There probably is less than that. Yes. But there's something about her that, like, you know, obviously from the get-go is like, you know, Brewster's character is like checking out like an older neighbor that he's, and his mom's like, what are you doing? Like, just like that cool mom.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, stop checking out girls. Yes. You're like, you got a girlfriend.
Yes, you have a girlfriend. Stop it.
Stop that. And then, but also, I mean, you bring up a good point about, you know, Imogen's character is Amy. You know, I feel like there's maybe something that I've noticed about this time period for like remakes and horror movies. Like, because I feel like, you know, in the 2000s and like the early 2010s, a lot of these underwritten female parts really are kind of, as we're looking at them retrospectively, they're just not very fleshed out, because like obviously the movie's centered around Colin Farrell and Anton Yelchin, obviously. Those are the two main characters in the movie. But at the same time, it's like, even though, you know, they're the centerpieces, like, you know, someone like Toni Collette, you know, thank goodness that she's in this, is one of those people that almost saves it in that female role, which I think, like I said, going back retrospectively, I can't think of any examples off the top of my head. But I'm sure there are a lot of these early 2010s and late 2000s movies that where it's like, wow, actually, this wasn't written very well for these parts.
No, I think you're right. I can't think of anything off the top of my head either, but it kind of feels like a constant thing, especially with these sort of horror movies, and when they're not kind of the central character. Because, and again, going back to the original, Amy is much more of a vital part, and she is more fleshed out, as in she is the girl who obviously really likes her boyfriend but doesn't quite like how fast he wants to go. She doesn't quite sure about how she wants to, what kind of relationship she wants compared to him. It's kind of that typical kind of teenage push and pull, and goes into some really kind of cool areas to discuss about sort of all these different things. And in the remake, it's not there because it's a thing I think the movie doesn't necessarily want to deal with. In fact, it's Imogen Poots who keeps wanting to have sex or push him further a little bit than he's willing to go, which is kind of, I think they did that on purpose because the other movie was such the other way, but but unfortunately they do nothing with that. It's the whole thing of setting him up of, oh, I want to be popular, I don't want to be friends with Evil Ed anymore, I want to be friends with these guys. But it doesn't, by the end of the movie, that is completely forgotten.
Because those friends, honestly, it's like, honestly, those first few scenes are the only times you really see that friendship him trying to abandon Evil Ed.
Yes.
And then the friendship develop between those other guys. Like, it's really not even much of a, like, it's just like a false start where, like, they're not in the movie that much.
No, because by the time you get into the third act, it is literally, okay, it's an action movie. We need to defeat the bad guy. And yeah, all those kind of themes that, as you said, it's a false start. All the themes of the movie kind of fall away because it's now like, oh, no, it's fighting vampires, which usually I'm fine with. It's just kind of more, I think one of my pet peeves with movies is when you set up something, but don't follow through with it because you go somewhere else, you just abandon it. Yeah. And it only, it's not always a pet peeve. I love plenty of movies where they do that. It's just, I don't, I like the movie enough not to care. But when, and I generally did like Fright Night. This is not a movie that I don't like. It's just, I'm like, oh, but you set up these themes and then you didn't follow through with them. I kind of wish it was there a little bit more, but this is 2011 and we are making an action movie and we have Colin Farrell as the vampire. So we need to focus on Colin Farrell, which I get, but at the same time, it's
Yeah. And I think certain movies, something like this, like for instance, it, where it is more of an action film is a little bit more permissible for that, or forgivable, I suppose, for not fleshing out things as much, because really you're just there to watch the action and also watch all the scares and the horror and what all of that. So, I mean, I suppose, you know, maybe we're asking too much for something like this, but at the same time, you know, sometimes if you, you know, revisit something and, you know, it's something that is a property that has already existed previously to it, it has a comparison to it. So I guess where we, you know, see a little bit of that, you know, Craig Giuseppe, who directed this movie, I guess he would want to go the more action route than the setting up of what the original film set out to do.
Oh, no, I think that's a really good point, because I think Do Fright Night does have a comparison, which I even keep going back to when I said off the top of the show, I don't have, I like the original a lot. I just don't have the history with it. And yet I'm keep going back to it because I've got this kind of counterpoint of like, oh, but this other film did this and this decided to do this. I don't know which is the right answer, because it just depends on your taste and your mood. But, you know, this is a most and foremost a horror action movie. This is a lot about a lot of characters running. This is a lot of, and Colin Farrell is a great villain because he is kind of that, I guess, for lack of a better word, when the characters run, he walks and he still catches up to them. He's got that kind of magical slasher quality to him. So I think it's very much more concerned about the pacing of the thing, not exactly the anything else. And I don't think I can blame the movie for that, because that's what the movie wants to do.
Right. And speaking of magic, the one thing that did definitely age, did not age very well, is the special effects.
Oh, no.
So like if we're looking back at the 85, the special effects are just insanely amazing.
Yes.
Obviously, because all those practical effects around the time, you know, you can think of John Carpenter's The Thing, you know, as a perfect example. And there's a million other examples of, you know, like American Werewolf in London, around this whole, like in that 80s. And I know everyone who's listening who's seen any 80s films knows how great practical effects are.
Yes.
Especially with those films. But like with this one, the effects, especially like maybe the car chase stuff, very noticeable. That's something I noticed when I was like, oh goodness. Like the budget was probably getting Colin Farrell on board.
Colin Farrell, David Tennant, and probably Anton Yelchik, and maybe even Toni Collette. I think the money was definitely put into the cast more than anything else, because even at the end when you see Colin Farrell's more monstrous qualities with his long nails, his kind of weird face, that kind of those special effects didn't quite hold up as much as I would have liked. Even I didn't see this from like going, oh, that's some 2011 CGI.
Which is, I mean, you think about other movies around the time or even earlier movies, and you're like, how did we get this far? Or maybe it's because, like we said, it's the money's in the cast and you know, it's, that's just maybe where things go.
Exactly. You've got to put your money somewhere. And I'm kind of glad they put it in the cast. Is there anything else you want to say about Fright Night before we move on?
I just wanted to say a shout out to Brewster, which is Daniel's cat. I know he'll be listening to this. And so I know that's because Fright Night is one of Daniel's favorite movies. So I definitely, when I picked this, I definitely thought of like, oh yeah, I probably should say something about Daniel and his cat.
Yes. So. Yes. We do have to talk about Daniel Epler and his cat Brewster, because if there's one thing Daniel loves, it's Fright Night and the original. I actually don't know how he feels about the original. I don't know how he actually feels about the remake.
Neither do I.
which is probably the reason why he's been quiet about it. But no, we have to shout out for Daniel because he does love the original, and he has done quite a wonderful episode, I think, on Cobwebs. I want to say it was with Stephanie. I could be wrong. And he just talks about his love for the original. So you should definitely listen to that.
It's great.
Yeah.
It was one of the earlier ones too.
Yes, it was. I like remakes that try and do the opposite of the original, like say the Suspiria remake, which is not a movie, which goes completely in the opposite. You know, the original Suspiria, which is one of my favorite movies, is all color with no plot. The remake is all plot and no color, which I kind of love it for doing that, because Suspiria is not a movie that you can just remake. And I don't necessarily think Fright Night is a movie that you can just remake, even though they did remake it in both points, but they decided to go with, I like the fact that they made Jerry so different.
Yeah. I don't know if you recall one of the first movie marathon episodes, on Cobwebs.
Yes, I do.
with Chris, Daniel, and I, but yes. I snuck in Suspiria because
at 6 a.m.
I wanted to fuck with him. Mainly because I do love that movie, and I'm one of the only ones in the group who does love that movie.
Yes.
But also because it's 6 a.m. and
I was more shocked by the placement, I think, more than the fact that, though, Chris's reaction was the greatest thing ever on that one. I could see his face. Kill me now, please. What are you doing to me? I was like,
it's actually a Western.
Yes, that's what you should have done. You should have just picked a Western. And just his face, it's just like, oh my God. But I was just like, Suspiria remake at 6 a.m.? Ha! But I like the the chutzpah of putting Suspiria remake at 6 a.m. in a 24-hour marathon.
Trying to put everyone to sleep.
Yes. Perfect. Absolutely perfect.
And then when they wake in and out of their like their fever dream, they're gonna see the last sequence and they're gonna be like, what the fuck was going on?
It's been very calm up to that point, and maybe slightly violent, and then you just get up to that last point and you're like, how many boobs does she have? What?
Whose blood is that? Yes. Where's all? What is happening right now?
It goes completely.
Is that Dionysus in the corner?
Yes. Oh my God! It would. Yeah, you just. Yeah, it is such. That is the perfect definition of a slow burn movie. Because I really actually do like the remake. And
I mean, I love the original too.
The original movies.
Make clear, everyone. I love both.
Yes, but that remake, because I knew it looked different, and I trusted what's his name,
Luca Guadagnino,
and then I'm sitting there and I'm just like going, oh, we are doing something. And then time I got to the end, I was just like going, what the hell is happening, and can we just have another hour of that?
Mm-hmm.
Or make this movie 4 hours, let's do it.
I was actually at the theaters with the boys when we watched it. I want to say I was with Seth and Chris. So
yeah. What does Chris do when he's not enjoying a movie in the theater? Does he get fidgety, or do you just hear him sighing a lot?
Yeah. He's a character. He's either drinking or taking pictures of him drinking.
Yeah.
So that's usually what he does.
Yeah. That's pretty much it. And with that, the credits roll for Fright Night, and we go in. We're gonna get ready for In Bruges. Now, did you want to do just the one trailer for In Bruges, or
we can do two?
Okay, yep. Okay, so for In Bruges, maybe one of the best scripts maybe written in a movie. Nathan, what would your first trailer be for In Bruges?
Well, I'm actually gonna do a movie that is directed and I want to say written by his brother.
Other McDonough. Yes.
John Michael McDonough.
Yeah.
Which is starring Brendan Gleeson, who's also in In Bruges, mm-hmm. and Don Cheadle and Mark Strong.
Yes. As well. Yes.
And it's The Guard from 2011.
Yes.
I've got some information about that murder last night.
What murder?
How many murders have you had in the last 24 hours?
Well, that's for us to know and you to find out.
Only wish I brought me handcuffs.
I don't think your mammy'd be too pleased about that now.
Your dad head in to attend a briefing from a fella who's over from the FBI.
Now, these men are highly dangerous, in the vicinity of $500 million worth of cocaine on board.
Yes, Sergeant.
I thought only black lads were drug dealers and Mexicans.
Apologize to the man.
Apologize for what?
For your racist slurs, for one thing.
I'm Irish, sir. Racism is part of my culture.
Such a good movie. And confession, I thought those two were the same people for years until I think the Billboards movie, when I realized, hang on, wait, there's more than one McDonough. So yeah, that is, right? This is quite a recent discovery. I just thought it was just all one guy making all those movies.
I mean, honestly, until, I mean, I think this was the first one I watched. I watched Calvary 2, the other one that John Michael has done. And I think it was around, the person who introduced me to In Bruges was somebody, it was a coworker of mine from when I worked at a record store. And I remember falling in love with it, watching it like 15, 20 times. Like, you know, within that time I worked at that record store. So I've seen it probably 50 times now, because it's literally my favorite movie beside, anyway, we'll get into that later. But around the same time, he mentioned like, you should watch The Guard, also has Brendan Gleeson in it. And then I remember when I watched it, I was like, oh, McDonough did this too. And then I was like, oh, wait a minute. And I did some research and I was like, oh, it's his brother. Got it.
Yeah.
But I did not know that either.
Yeah. I went into watching The Guard and Calvary fully thinking they were Martin McDonough, and did for years. Like, if you would have talked to me like 3 years ago, 4 years ago, I would have gone, oh yeah, same guy, Martin McDonough. What? There's a brother? Hang on. No, but The Guard is such a sadly dark movie. It's really funny, again, the McDonoughs have a way of spinning a sentence, and those movies with Brendan Gleeson are just,
he's just perfect
in all three of those roles, including this one in Bruges we're going to be talking about. But no, that is going to be a great trailer.
You know, we talked a lot about Colin Farrell's eyebrows. We'll just talk about Brendan Gleeson's frown.
Yes.
That's probably the best way. Like, his, honestly, both of these guys just have, you know, incredible nonverbals.
Oh my God. And yes. And as we'll get into Ralph Fiennes' nonverbals. Oh my God. This movie.
Oh yeah. And Ralph Fiennes too. Yeah. Of course.
For such a talky movie, these facial expressions that are going to be coming up in Bruges are insane.
Unforgettable.
I'm going for a little bit different, but I just kind of, for some reason, kept thinking Humphrey Bogart while watching In Bruges this time around. So I'm going to go for We're No Angels, Michael Curtiz, 1955.
And We're No Angels is the international comedy hit that's going to have you laughing like the devil, with Humphrey Bogart and his buddies as three wonderful and wacky fugitive convicts trying to break out of Devil's Island. They even have the bloodhounds confused, because these three happy outlaws have talent. For instance, Bogart's a genius. He can sell anybody anything.
Yes, that's better. No stomach at all. Stop breathing.
Peter Ustinov is an artist. He can open anything. That's how he got to Devil's Island in the first place.
Very tangentially, similar but not similar. You essentially have three criminals who have broken out of prison and they're hiding out. So I kind of liked the whole criminals kind of waiting around for something and then kind of getting involved into something within that area. Again, with Colin Firth getting involved with Posey Clemens and the whole movie and being shot and all that kind of thing. And just there's an old sense of movie tough guy that runs all through In Bruges, which I just friggin' love. So yes, my first trailer is going to be We're No Angels.
I still need to see that movie.
I only saw it like this year. It's really good. It's like another also Christmas set movie, which is kind of weird. So yeah, it's kind of,
you like my Christmas movies.
Yes.
And I do like crime.
Exactly. So, yes,
you know, might as well do both.
Like, you might presents, as well. Yes.
So it's presents, even if you steal those presents.
Exactly. No, it's absolutely perfect. Do you have a second trailer that you want to mention?
Yeah. So another movie about crime and a bunch of like, what the hell's going on? Kind of less. This movie is a lot less plot driven. but I want to talk about the Coen brothers' Burn After Reading.
So
this is some senior guy who screwed the pooch.
This could put a big dent in my surgeries.
Big time.
I have gone just about as far as I can go with this body.
Right.
Hello.
Osborne Cox?
Yes.
I thought you might be worried about the security of your shit. I've been
working on a car. What you're engaged in is blackmail.
I'm a mere good Samaritan.
Give me the CD.
As soon as you give us the money, dickwad.
Where's the money?
He didn't give it to me.
Oh, perfect. I love this movie.
Is one of, I mean, just such an, I mean, obviously the Coen brothers put out a lot of films that are, would be considered like contemporary masterpieces and probably will be remembered, you know, years down the road of just like they put out knockout after knockout. But like Burn After Reading, I feel like is one of those movies that not as many people talk about. And it's definitely one of their sleeper hits, I think.
Me too. I think the Coens have always had done really well writing dumb characters doing dumb things. And I think in a very smart way, because those boys are absolutely very smart cookies. But there's a way of how people are just willfully not understanding each other in Burn After Reading that I absolutely love. And just them getting deeper and deeper inside this kind of conspiracy that doesn't exist. I really enjoy this movie.
Yeah, the only person who has any semblance of, like, I would say, what's the word, maybe, like, you know what, like, you're kind of intelligent is J.K. Simmons, who is barely in the movie.
Exactly. Yes.
Everyone else is just fumbling around like an idiot.
They're fumbling around in the dark. It's a movie that doesn't get talked about as much from their filmography, but I think should, because it is quite a treasure.
Yeah, and obviously like a Coen brother film, it has an amazing cast. So Clooney, McDormand, Malkovich.
Brad Pitt. Yeah, Malkovich, Brad Pitt. Yeah.
Swinton, Richard Jenkins as well.
Yes. It's a magical movie, and it's Coen's dialogue is just perfect.
Yeah, and I think that would be maybe the through line of like what The Guard and my choice of Burn After Reading, and also in Bruges, dialogue is incredibly important in all those movies.
You're absolutely right, because dialogue is at the forefront of In Bruges, and my second trailer, dialogue isn't actually that important. But I'm going for another Colin Farrell movie, and I think it'll just be a fun trailer to show. It's Phone Booth from 2002.
Someone's got his number.
Yeah.
Don't even think about leaving that booth.
Wrong number, pal.
I'm aiming at you right now. Can you feel it, Stu?
Did you call me Stu? Who is this?
Someone who enjoys watching you. I have a 30 caliber bolt action 700 with a hands-hold tactical scope.
You mean like a rifle?
At this range, the exit wound ought to be about the size of a small tangerine.
You're bluffing.
There's only one way to find out.
Oh my God, you shot him.
Look at all of the people, Stu.
This is kind of, I put this in because I always think that, or thought for years that In Bruges was the movie that made Colin Farrell, but it wasn't. He had a whole decade of movies before this. This was kind of his comeback in a way, going back to a smaller movie, really concentrating on the dialogue, all that kind of thing. And 2002 is actually when he first started blowing up. And it's actually a really smart movie. Because I know Joel Schumacher, before his death, was kind of made fun of a lot for certain sort of Batman and Robin movies, and
what could you be talking about?
Exactly. I don't know.
What bat nipples are you talking about?
I don't know don't know exactly what you're talking about, the bat nipples, but I think it was a rumor of certain movies.
Must have been something I remembered in my childhood.
Exactly. And I think because he was so glossy and so Schumacher that people kind of forgot that he did actually know how to make a movie. And Phone Booth is just a dirty little thriller. It's set in pretty much one place, in a phone booth, and it just kind of rips along and is just kind of fun. And I'm kind of glad that people are, even if they had to wait till after his death, are kind of going back and kind of reappreciating the Schumacher.
Oh yeah. I mean, obviously going back to that childhood memory of him, that, I mean, those were some of my firsts, was watching, you know, the Val Kilmer and the Clooney Batmans.
Yeah,
because he did the Val Kilmer one, right?
Yeah, he did. Yeah, he did two of them. Yeah,
both of those. Yeah. So I watching those as a kid, but yeah, just thinking about him, I actually, Phone Booth, I can't talk, is not a movie that I have seen, although I have seen Buried and movies that are very much like it. But I've never watched that one in particular, but I've always wanted to watch that movie.
No, it's, yeah, it was kind of one of those movies that I think we watched on a whim and was kind of surprised by, like, oh, this is actually like just really good, just really fast paced, nothing really to do with the dialogue. It's all about the pacing again. But it's just one of those kind of movies that kind of work the way it needs to work. And yeah, I mean, I don't know, man, I was a little bit older when time Batman and Robin and Batman Forever came out. I can't imagine what imprint bat nipples would have had on a child.
Yeah.
That would have been something.
Well, my best friend is, he's a little younger than me, but I will delve into some personal, when we lived together. I bought a Batman and Robin poster from that movie.
Yeah.
And I actually thumbtacked it to the ceiling above his bed. And I remember the first night that he discovered that existed, I just heard heard a scream and then like an incredible laughter. And he kept it up there from that point on. And so, you know, it's something that, you know, haunts people's dreams or even, you know, makes dreams better.
Yeah, depending on your thing, because I can just imagine that would be a different conversation piece when someone would come over, they'd look up at the ceiling and go, what the hell is that?
it's just two guys and they're fist bumping too. That's what's funny.
Oh, God. I think we could have a whole conversation about Batman and Robin, but it's one of those kind of, yeah, it's what it is. And Schellmaker definitely had a very specific sense of style and POV, and everything was pretty. Though I guess I could say the closest I had was The Lost Boys with that saxophonist.
Which, yeah, well, I mean, come on.
Yeah. That's a mood. That's a definite mood. And I love, and the whole movie and the 2 second shot of a friggin' greased up saxophonist with very tight purple pants is kind of the one thing that people remember.
Did he have a choker on too?
I think he did. Yeah. It was very,
it's an image you can't get out.
No.
It
opens the movie and yeah, you cannot get that image out of your head when you watch Lost Boys.
I mean, this is the second time we brought up Corey Feldman inadvertently. So.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. Very important.
And two adjacent films.
Yes, very much so. Because it's actually surprised Lost Boys did not come up as a trailer for Fright Night, because I think that a little bit of DNA has definitely crept into Fright Night from the Lost Boys. But losing my train of thought. Phone Booth is my second trailer. With that, we might as well get into In Bruges, directed by Martin McDonagh, not the other one. There are two different McDonaghs from 2008.
Mr. Blakely?
Yes.
You have a message.
Number one, why aren't you in when I told you to be in? You better be in when I call again, or there'll be now to pay up. I'm telling you.
He swears a lot, doesn't he? Let's go out.
Go out where?
The pub.
Yes.
Harry, I've got an idea. I'm going to go back to my room, jump into the canal, see if I can escape. If you go outside and round the corner, you can shoot at me from there and try and get me.
I'll go outside, then which way, right or left?
You go right, don't you?
Okay, on the count of 1, 2, 3, go.
Who says it?
Oh, you say it.
You guys are crazy.
1, 2, 3, go!
Now, you've said you've watched this movie 50 times. Or it's one of your favorite movies. Do you remember the first? Do you actually remember the first time you saw this movie?
Yeah. So, you know, I brought up that I worked at a record store here where I live. Mm. And we also sold DVDs and Blu-rays there too. Very small amount of Blu-rays. But I remember my coworker talking about that, because I was just kind of discovering more Tarantino and Christopher Nolan films, just like really like Fincher films, and like trying to expand myself on things that were kind of that I had missed out from growing up. And a lot of things he's like, well, you should also bring up you should watch In Bruges. And I remember finding it on the DVD shelf and just taking it home to borrow. And I remember watching it and just like laughing out loud, maybe the first time I watched it, just because of how outrageous this black comedy is, because there's just so much in there. Like, wait, what did they just say?
oh yeah, like, just warning, there's a C word that might come up, just because I, this got one of my favorite speeches has that word a lot in it, so
this movie has a lot of fun little bits that you can you can talk about with some great lines that involve some colorful words. But yeah, I just remember doing that, and then I think I watched it actually a second time. Like, I didn't take it home. I didn't bring it back. I actually kept it for a second, and then I watched it again, and then I noticed all the subtleties of, like, this is actually a pretty sad movie, not just comedic, and it really spoke to me, mainly because I've always enjoyed more melancholic films, but also as somebody who uses comedy just in a lot of emotional situations, just kind of, that's something that I do, is that I, instead of reacting like a normal human being, I'll say something dark or comedic, but like, that's just the way I cope.
Yes.
You know? And so something like that, I mean, I've gotten a lot better at it as I've subsequently grown up, obviously, and I'm more empathetic. So I don't cross those lines as much as I used to. But yeah, this movie just, it all came to me, and I just remember loving it from that point on. And then subsequently I had bought the film eventually on Blu-ray, and I've watched it, like I said, 50 times. It's not like a joke. I've probably watched it 50 times.
I don't blame you. I think I've seen this movie a lot as well, because I was actually just trying to think, oh, when is the first time I saw this movie? And I can't remember. It's been one of those movies that I felt has always been around, which is maybe why I keep thinking it's a lot older than I think it is. It must have been my partner who showed this to me, because I know we had I have the Blu-ray now, but we had the DVD, and I think that was the first time I saw it. So it must have been my partner going, what, you haven't seen In Bruges? Okay, we're watching In Bruges. Even though I think it's a lot older, I think it's been in my life way longer than it actually has been, because this was made in 2008. I keep thinking this was like made in 2001, which it wasn't. And I think you're right. I had this sort of the same reaction. I loved the humor of it. I love how dark it goes. And the more times I've watched it, the more I realized how sad it is, because this movie is about death. It is about kind of coming to the end of your life and kind of reckoning with everything you've done in it. But at the same time, it has got this amazing, amazing script.
Oh my
that
God.
Just pops along. I mean, you can tell that everyone, especially Farrell, Gleason, and Ralph Fiennes, took me like my third watch to realize it was Ralph Fiennes. I don't know, just there's a way he holds his face. I just didn't recognize him.
It's the way that he has a nose.
Yes, he has a nose, and he's like,
wait, you actually have a nose in this movie.
Where did your nose come from? I didn't realize you had one. And yeah, they are just digging into the script. It's like, you can tell, I love the kind of movie you're watching when you realize actors are just happy to play around with the dialogue, or not play around with it, but just speak the certain dialogue. And this kind of movie has it. And yeah, it's got some very colorful language, because we are dealing with an Irish commentary.
It's an Irish film. So you're going to get something.
So you're going to get something. And it has one of the greatest speechables of all time that involves the word cunt. But the way Brendan Gleeson says it is just... oh, it is just incredible.
Take that back
about my cunt kids. It's going too far, mate.
And they're so serious about it too.
And and it goes from that to these amazingly sad speeches about things that have happened in these guys' lives, because essentially these are two hitmen who are hiding out in the town of Bruges in Belgium. So many great, where the fuck is that town? Jokes.
Fairy tale.
It's a fairy tale. It's a fucking fairy tale, mate. Again,
you
as
really
we said,
say that?
As we said, there's language, but it's just done in a great way. And one thing I love about Irish and British writing is the way that they can use curse words. We'll get into that because that's what the dialogue is. It is. I mean, if you ever watched, have you seen In the Loop, the show, or the movie that was made of it?
I have not.
Oh, it's guy who, I can't forget his name, but he also did Zeep.
Okay.
Yeah. And when you watch In the Loop, you realize there's a way poetry can be used with swear words. And it is just, it's literally about a British government, the PR guy trying to make sure everything stays on straight and narrow, which it never does. And he can just, the way the meter that the writer is using to actually convey swear words, it is absolutely like from bean to cup, you fuck up. And I love how the Irish and the British have always had this kind of knack for it. And it is all over in Bruges. They make it delightful. It's never a point of making it something shocking. It's just part of the patter of the dialogue. And this is very much in Bruges. And just the way these guys talk to each other is so goddamn glorious. As I'm going to keep going back to the script on this one because it's just fantastic.
I mean, it just helps that Martin McDonagh, originally a playwright.
Yes.
A screenwriter. Mm. I mean, that's where he came from first. Mm. And so I know a lot of people who are from Ireland and then in the UK in general, probably know a lot more about his theater work prior to this movie. And so I've done a little bit of digging since then. I've seen I've seen his short film Six Shooter, which is comes as an extra on this. I have the second sight in Bruges.
Yeah,
is immaculate. And I'm so happy that I have it. But you know, not just Six Shooter, but like it's almost like natural, like you were saying, in the dialogue of, you know, these people, because comedy is just at the forefront of communication. And yes. I that's actually something that I was reading. I've been reading a Hitchcock book, and it was talking about, one of the chapters was talking about Hitchcock and his Britishness versus his Englishness. And and obviously Hitchcock stayed in America mostly, so he wasn't actually in England that often, early part of his career. But they were talking a lot about the communication aspect of it and how the language is developed and how shocking a lot of British and Irish kind of language is in comparison of just everyday conversation. Obviously, you know, neither of us are in those countries, and so we can't really speak fully about that cultural phenomenon, but I think it's really like kind of just endearing to see in a film or in these films that we've seen that can show us this.
Oh, absolutely. Though I do, like, sometimes I just like to read travel guides to see what they say about certain countries, and both Britain and then I read Australia because it's just, what does an outside view think of Australia? I do like the point of the warning of, like, they will swear a lot and it's not always an insult. And I'm like, no, that is correct, because the word cunt does get thrown around a lot in Australia, and it's not always an insult. It really depends on context. Yeah. And same with in Bruges. It's just this kind of fascinating thing. And you're right, I love the play aspect in Bruges because it really does have that play-like feel. And I love the fact that they just keep it in one small town, because you keep that, it's still cinematic, but it feels like you're in a play, which I absolutely love.
You're in a fucking fairy tale.
You're in a fucking fairy tale. Come on. Yeah. And I love how the language is not threatening, because it's not used to be threatening. Even in the cunt speech, it's not actually a threat.
It's two old friends just getting together and being like, what the hell are we doing right now?
What's going on? I mean, it's just, yeah, you can tell they're old friends and they have history, because it's all throughout this movie. So when Donald Gleason goes, look, you're a cunt, all that's going to happen is you're going to become a bigger cunt, and maybe the difference, you'll have some more cunt kids. It's not actually an insult. It's just two guys talking. And of course, he takes a brumbridge to his two cunt kids, which he says, but it's just...
Yeah, he's like, I'll agree about the other bits, but you take that part about my cunt kids, because that's not who I am. Like, exactly. That's going overboard, mate.
It's what he said. And it is so just kind of within that kind of grounded British-Irish kind of language and how they talk to each other, that it, even though it is such an artful piece of dialogue, especially when you have Gleason talking to the Flemish guy about the nooks and crannies, is it?
yes.
Yes.
The alcoves?
The alcoves is what you mean. Yes, alcoves. It is such wordplay and delicious, because it's constantly throwing word. Yeah, it's all these kind of word little plays of like little kind of cute things. But it's so artful yet so grounded at the same time, and that's kind of why I love this movie, apart from the fact that ever since I've seen this, I've always wanted to go to Bruges. Because of this movie. Yeah, I've actually had friends send me postcards of they've gone to Bruges with just like, in Bruges. because of this movie. So I think it kind of made their tourism for a little while. It definitely made their tourism pop more.
It's a shithole. According to Colin Farrell, it's a shithole. I wouldn't want to. I grew up in Dublin. I won't repeat the other part that he said. But
oh, I can't. Yeah. If I grew up in a. If I grew up on a farm, I'd like this, but I grew up in Dublin, so I don't.
Oh, man.
Oh, it's just,
a beautiful movie, though.
It's a beautiful movie. And the fact that it's also about, I mean, I love the fact that Bruges is essentially purgatory for all these characters.
Yeah.
And they love how, because the fact they're looking at paintings, they're talking about just kind of sitting in place, waiting. They're sitting in their guilt because you find out what happened in the beginning. Or the reason why they're there is they've been told to hide out because I didn't realize on this first, it was this watch, I realized it was his at Colin Farrell's first hit job.
Yep.
And he's meant to kill a priest, but he accidentally as well kills a child. And when you get to know, and this goes against everything that Ralph Fiennes' character stands for. You do not hurt children. And of course, this turned into a much bigger deal. So they've been told to go to, it's a fucking fairy tale, Bruges. And that is essentially the plot. It's a very sort of small kind of plot. There's no kind of momentum, but it's just about how, the mess the characters kind of get into while they're there, while they're bored, which I kind of love the idea of that. It's because as soon you don't even see anything, but all you hear is Colin Farrell going, "It's a shithole," and then it's not a shithole.
Yeah, just and then he's using his eyebrows to be mopey.
Yes,
the whole time he's shrugging. He's putting his head down in a boat, crossing his arms. Like I said, the nonverbals are really what's selling this because of that purgatory.
Exactly. He is bored out of his mind. He is guilty out of his mind. He feels shitty, all kinds of things. And now he's stuck in this town he doesn't want to be in, that he's not impressed by, that he knows, and more importantly, he knows he fucked up more than anything. And he's just sitting in it. And I love how the whole thing is like, oh no, you have to sit in this mess that you made, and you have to do it in purgatory. And it happens to be this actual small town. The whole concept of it just opens up to me every more, because the first time you watch In Bruges, you just hit by that dialogue, and it's hilarious, and it's just cheeky, and it's just kind of moves along everything. It's the dialogue that moves everything along, and those nonverbal cues. I mean, Gleason's frown is just a beautiful thing. I mean, when he's looking over the town from the tower, his face of just kind of, this is cool to, okay, fine, maybe Colin Farrell's a little bit right about this not being as interesting as I thought it was, or...
He wants to do all the touristy stuff.
He wants to do all the touristy stuff because he's trying to help Farrell because he knows that he fucked up, and it's, I don't know, it's just, you're right, and Colin's eyebrows are when he's shrugging, and his whole body just moves up when he shrugs. It's a delightful thing to watch because he's a big kid, essentially. This is a guy who has not had a chance to grow up, so he doesn't necessarily know how to handle situations other than to constantly poke the bear.
And speaking of nonverbals, there is one particular scene with both Colin Farrell and Brendan Gleeson involving Jimmy the Dwarf. Or in this movie, he'd be according.
You
to
can't
them.
Call it. You can't call him that. Well, oh,
yeah. See, he's like, say, hey. He's like, well, he's like, look, they're filming. Like the way he's, I'm like, what are you talking about? He's this big kid that hasn't grown up, right?
No.
So, but I mean, when he meets him again, and he's at a bar, and I think Jimmy's making out with a prostitute.
Yes.
And Colin and Brendan Gleeson comes up. Or no, Colin Farrell says like he wants to like talk to him and stuff. Mm. So he like pokes him on the mouth because he's already done a little bit of cocaine.
Yes.
And Brendan Gleeson had just went to the bathroom to do a little bit himself.
Mm.
And then like he just pops around the corner and like puts his head on Colin Farrell's shoulder. And he's like, you guys want to do some cocaine? And it's just the way your face, it just sells it so perfectly. And there's so many moments where just you kind of get lost in the just that, like, yeah, they're in hell right now, they're in purgatory, not hell, they're in purgatory literally. But you're having so much fun with them even though they're in so much agony. They're just trying to feel alive.
Oh my god, the moment when he sees there's a film crew, and the fact that when he sees Jamie the little person, and then he's just trying to justify, but why, it's like, you shouldn't call him that. He doesn't, see, that's why it would suck to be a little person, because everyone's calling you, like,
He's like, I've heard a lot of them kill themselves. he's trying to talk to Chloe. He's like, is that a way to pick up somebody?
Oh my God. It reminds me of True Romance when Christian Slater is like trying to ask a girl and going to, do you want to go see some Sonny Chiba double? And then you're just like, that is not how you talk to a girl. At least not Clemens Posey. I don't know. It's just this adorable, he's so adorable yet so wrong in every single way. He's like this, yeah, he's a kid. He doesn't know what to say. He always says the wrong thing. He gets so excited about the smaller stuff. Especially when he comes into the bar with Gleason and he's just had cocaine. He's like, oh yeah, I found like 5 ounces of cocaine. I got them. 1 ounce, well, 4 ounces. One of them is already in me.
Four ounces actually, because I already have one in me. He's like, all right, give me some of that cocaine. Because like at that time, like you said, Brendan Gleason had processed it. It's like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm gonna have fun like this too.
Yeah. Because he's trying to keep Colin Farrell on the straight and narrow. Right, like they have to wait for the call they have to wait for the call, I think, from Harry, who's Ralph Fiennes. They have to sit tight, they have to behave. And there's one thing that Colin Farrell does not want to do, and that is behave. He wants he said, I'm from Dublin. I'm used to this big city life. I don't want the quiet one. I want to go to the pub. I want to do cocaine. I want to, you know,
I want to watch Dwarf being filmed on the street.
Yes. So this is what I want to do. I don't want to go to a gallery. I don't want to go down in a canal looking at old buildings.
I don't want to see Jesus's blood.
I don't want to see Jesus's blood. I don't want to do any of that. And it's just kind of, yeah, look, I'm not going to lie. This dynamic reminds me of my partner travel, because I love museums. I love galleries, and Dan likes the pub. So there's always this kind of sighing of like, we've been in this gallery 4 hours. I'm like, look, I'm going to go freaking see the freaking Tripec from the thing. And this is what we're doing. Oh yes, I'm going to go to that old building. And just, yeah, I'm just like, yes, I know this dynamic with traveling with people. You always want to do different things. And it's not unlike most holidays or vacations people have been on when they're traveling with people and they want to do different things. And then you kind of get caught up in this kind of weird madness. But what it sort of says about life and how guilt is and what purgatory is, I kind of love. It's says a lot about how you deal with guilt, your own actions, and how you take responsibility. And it goes very dark in that respect, because it is very much, oh, you kill a child, you kill yourself. That is the rule.
That is the honor. That's the code of honor.
That is the code of honor.
Yeah, that Ray does. He wants to follow.
Yeah.
And once that, he's like, well, I mean, if I killed a kid, that's what I would just shoot myself right there on spot.
Yeah.
That's what he said. And then, you know, we have Ken, who is, you know, Brendan Gleeson's character, just saying like, he's not like that. Like, he's different. He's struggling with this. And like, he's not like you, mainly because, you know, Ray, you're a cunt.
Yes.
that phone scene too, where, you know, Ray's on the other line after you see Ken talk to him and say like, you know, like it's like, I didn't kill him. You know, it's like, and he's like, he's on a train, you know, bye. And then he's like, and he just starts beating the phone up. And then his wife's like, it's like, Ray, it's an inanimate object. And then he just yells, you're an inanimate fucking object. And then not too long after, he's like, I'm sorry, I said that you were an inanimate object.
No, I love kind of, you can tell he's got a good home life. Like, he's got kids, he's got his wife who he loves, except when he yells at her that she's an inanimate fucking object. They're generally got a, like, it's Christmas, they're kind of getting ready for the kind of the celebration, and he's worried about him going over there, and she's like, oh, it's dangerous, can't you send one of the boys?
He's
like,
yeah,
no, it's
a matter of honor.
Yes. And he is all about honor, which I kind of love, because most crime movies, it's about people pretending to have honor and then completely bulldozing it, or criminals not having honor. This is very much about a criminal who has a code, and he will stick to that code no matter what, even with the end of this movie. Even in shootouts. Like, I love
the shootout.
Oh my God, the hotel scene in the shootout. And they're just arguing with this pregnant lady who owns the hotel, going, I'm not going anywhere. And I know you're not going to shoot me. I figured this out because I'm pregnant. So what are we going to do about this? And they have this sort of conversation, and it's kind of, it puts you on their side and realizes that there's good and bad in both people, that they do have this very specific honor code that you're just not necessarily spending 2 hours with these completely horrible people. I mean, yes, they're hitmen.
Nobody in this movie is disliked. Like, everyone can be likable in some regard.
Yes.
I don't feel like, even though, you know, like, Ray is probably the worst of the bunch, he still has moments of, like, humanity to him that I feel like everyone in this movie, regardless of the awful things that they say to each other, like, there's a sense of, you know, friendship and also a sense of, like you said, there's that, it's just like the purgatory. It's like, it's that murky, you got good and bad. There's no one-sidedness to this. And there's different ways to handle these kind of situations. And so that's kind of what we see.
Oh yeah. Cause characters are flinging racial insults, homophobic insults, little person, dwarf insults at each other. And, but then you'll have this, especially the moment where they're all doing cocaine in the hotel. And Jamie is
Manson-esque
war between the blacks and the whites. And then, of course, you've got Colin Farrell just like poking the bear, going, "Oh, so what about the Vietnamese? You don't want them on that? No, they go with the blacks." Like, really? You don't want the Vietnamese on your side? Jesus Christ! Like, he's playing with him. Like, he knows this guy's a dick, and he's just poking him to see where he can get him to. And then Brendan Gleeson just says this amazing. Again, this is what I love about this movie. The speeches are all short, but pack punch. He sort of says, "Well, my wife was a beautiful black woman and she was murdered by a white man.
Where would I be in this side of the war?"
Exactly.
In your war.
Yeah. And then he also mentions that it was Ralph Fiennes who went out and killed the guy who killed his wife.
Yeah.
And so Colin Farrell obviously knows the story, goes, yep, he did. And it's this kind of, you know, all these guys have history together and codes have been broken. So violence needs to happen. But from that point of view, you understand why this violence needs to happen and the kind of resignation from the characters of like, I'm not going to survive this holiday. I already know this. So I'm just going to kind of live in the moment a little bit, especially with Colin Farrell, but it's just these beautiful little moments, and then you'll just get like an ugly thing thrown at you, but you know these guys have layers of emotion that they're trying to, that they're not dealing with very well.
Yeah, because all they really know is violence. And to be honest, I think with maybe Brendan Gleeson's character is probably the most mature of the bunch, because he's maybe the fatherly figure that is kind of realized through Ray because of what he did and what Ray shoots, but like, Ray, shoots, the kid, and then Harry's after him. And, yes. And from seeing that, you see a lot of character development go against kind of what he originally has always had with, like, as Ken. He's always been working on Harry's side, and like now with this thing, it's almost like woken him up to, like, you know what, like, I don't know if I want to live like this anymore.
I want
to do something for this guy.
Yes. And also I think he sees Ray as a kid. Which again, this whole thing starts off with a kid, a little boy being murdered. And I think Ken is looking at Ray going, "You're just a kid. This was your first job. You're not old enough to know what you did." And I think it goes with that whole code throughout the movie of don't shoot a child. He's looking at him going, "You're just a big kid. I can't shoot you." And even though Ray does have a sort of a sense of, oh, he's not going to get out of this alive, especially when he's in the children's playground with a gun about to, or is he on the bridge? No, he's in the park when he's off himself. And it's Gleeson who stops him, even though he's been charged. He's also got a gun. It was meant to shoot him in the back of the head. Yeah. It's kind of works brilliantly in that kind of fast way. But at the sort of the same time, it's kind of these very specific codes that keep getting very much messier and messier as much as you lay them on top of each other. Like, which code is the friendship? Is it the friendship code? Is it the partner code? Is it the never kill a child code? Is it something else? And it kind of all gets very, very messy and very, very convoluted. And then it does end with that perfect scene of Ken telling Harry that, oh no, he's on a train. I don't know where he's going. He doesn't know where he's going. It's, you're just going to have to come and deal with it.
You're going to have to deal with me and I'll be here. We'll meet each other and see what happens.
See what happens.
He's like, I'm ready to die. If that's what he wants.
Yeah. And then of course, because Ray's a little shitbird for the whole time, you get the Canadian, oh my God, the Canadian, the what? recognize him on the train and then he gets taken back to Bruges. What are you saying?
That's for John Lennon, Yankee fucking. Oh man, we could just quote the movie the whole time.
Oh, I know. It's such a friggin' quotable movie.
The Vietnamese, you know?
Vietnamese, really? He doesn't even want the Vietnamese on his side. He's like seasoned, goes, oh, yeah. And it's, again, because Bruges is purgatory, so you can physically not leave it. And he's taken back and he gets bailed out of jail, but he's hanging out with Chloe, which is what he wanted to do in the first place. And it just comes full circle. And again, it's about those kind of codes and those kind of how you want to live your life that keep making everything messier because you're dealing with other people's codes and they don't always mesh or align or kind of whatever. And the messier it gets, the more glorious and sad it gets. I mean, when Ken goes back up to the tower, oh my God, when they beat the guy, oh my God, it's just perfect. But they go up to the tower.
the guy who was asking for money.
Yes. Oh my God.
The worker.
No. It's like, oh, do you take change? Yeah.
No, Englishman. It is closed.
Or at the beginning of the movie when he's trying to give him the change to get up to the tower in the first place, he's like, oh, I've got like £4.10. It's £5. Yeah, but I...
Could you spot me?
No, it's £5. He's like, oh, do you enjoy your work?
Yes, very much.
No, it's all kind of, yeah, it all, I mean, it's one of those movies where everything is set up perfectly. So by the time you have Ken back up in the tower and they have this sort of altercation with Harry and he's realizing that he sees Ray and he knows he needs to warn him. There's this beautiful moment that is set up right at the beginning of the movie. And the fact that they bring that ticket guy back is just perfect. And then that moment of him just dropping the coins off the tower to get people away is so, it's such a beautiful moment, even though you know what is happening and it's going to be incredibly painful, incredibly sad because you've grown to love this guy. Every sort of frown that he gives you, you've just kind of fallen in love with him. And then, I don't know, the dropping of the coins is one of my favorite moments in the movie. It is so poignant and just paling the toll man, as it were, I guess.
And also, I mean that on Raglan Road by the Dubliners that plays in the background as that's happening. It's just, I don't know, everything. So I know we kind of mentioned it about like the backdrop in Bruges itself, but the score of this film is just perfect. The other thing about this movie that's from the opening shots, like you just hear just piano and it's just kind of a light piano that kind of just trods along, and every single time I've watched this movie, I almost like just get invested in like what is going on in the background, just every little detail. Since I've seen it so much, but Carter Burwell, who did the score of this movie, like I would love this on vinyl because it is just, it's so good.
I was saying, just going back to the Coen brothers, the Carter Burwell, he is just the master of beautiful, simple music. And you're right, it is, the score in this movie is fantastic, and mainly because of Carter, because he's an amazing composer. But you're right, I mean, I just love the setting so much. I'm a sucker for those kind of old medieval towns. I love them so much. I could just, you know, just going to a marketplace and just seeing those old buildings, I'm just like, oh yes, so great. And but yeah, I don't know, it's kind of built out of the tourism of the age of the place, how old it is, and the art.
The art.
Oh my God, the art.
That's another purgatory reference there. They're looking at all these medieval hell and purgatory scenes at the same time.
Yes.
It's almost like on the nose with what's going on in their particular situation.
Yeah, it is so on the nose, but yet it's so perfect. Because again, first time I watched this, I didn't even click to all that. Just because I'm like, oh, this looks like a really cool town. Oh my God, I love the dialogue. I love the acting. And then the more times you watch it, maybe just because that's just how I watch movies. I don't always sort of take in everything the first time I watch them. But then the second time you're noticing everything in the background, and it is how old it is. The fact that they're kind of always surrounded by buildings, no matter, or canals, wherever they go, they're never in a sort of a flat space almost, because yeah, they are in purgatory, and kind of Bruges is the perfect backdrop for it. And it's kind of wanky to say, but yes, because it is called In Bruges, and Bruges is almost a character in this movie. I mean, everything is infused with that town square, the pubs that they go to. In fact, everywhere you go, you see these very similar types of buildings. It's very much infused with the movie, and you don't usually get settings like this in a movie. Maybe because it's just hard to shoot there. I don't know exactly why. But it does add this kind of infused character into the movie purely because of where they are. And I love how McDonough just settles into it and revels in it. It's like, yep, I've got this is my stage, and this is what I'm working with. And it feels the cinematicness and the play vibe of it at the same time. And it just so damn good.
Yeah. And I love the way he incorporates plays in this movie too, because I mean, there's a play with the, you know, with what Jimmy's doing in the filming, like, you know, and it goes all the way to the end. If anyone hasn't seen this, I don't want to ruin that part of the movie, but there's definitely, you know, the end of this film feels like, once again, we're in a fantastical, like, fairy tale land, or we're in this very otherworldly purgatory that we can't escape, and so it's indefinite, and I love that about this.
No, there's a moment in the part of the movie, and even the last line of the movie, I think, even counters toward that as well, and I won't ruin what that last line is, but it breaks me every single time. The ending is perfect. It is just this kind of circular, and you can kind of see it kind of repeating itself from the end point going right back to the beginning again. The movie is completely circular. And it works so brilliantly. This is my favorite thing he's done. I think this is his first full feature.
McDonough's, this is his first, yeah. And this is definitely my favorite thing he's done too.
Yeah, this is my favorite, just because I think it's the script works. He got the right place to film in. He understood that he needed to make it circular, because you could just go right back to the beginning and then watch it again and just be in this complete loop of watching In Bruges, which is actually, again, like purgatory, but again, not the worst way to spend your time. Because just the moments of dialogue, like, I completely forgot about the guy that Ken gets the gun from, and they're just talking about the alcoves and everything, and even
just, am I using the right word?
Alcoves? What? what's an alcove? And then when he's talking to Harry about him, and he's like, yeah, he's a character. It's like, yeah, keep talking about the alcoves. He goes, yeah, he does that, and it's just it feels like this movie has been rehearsed, like all those actors got into a stage and actually rehearsed this like a play, because the patter between them doesn't feel like new or forced. It feels like these guys have actually gotten together for 4 weeks to actually rehearse this dialogue. And I love it when you feel that in a movie. It's like the build up, this rapport.
So much chemistry.
So much chemistry. Insane. Yeah. And that's a chemistry I don't think you can have without rehearsal. So I didn't read into it to see the probably was, but by if it's a play and he's a playwright, then yeah, I can imagine him like going, nope. And it's a very British thing to do, is just to get into a room and just beat the script to death, so they know it inside out, so they can do those little verbal cues, which is so much of the movie and works so well, because it makes it cinematic, because it's not just people spouting this amazing dialogue. It's actually getting into these faces and seeing how they react to certain situations. And they do. And again, everyone holds themselves very, very differently and very sort of most archetypally. Like, you do have Ray, who's shrugging a lot, who's bent down, who doesn't want to be there. You have Brendan Gleeson, who's the old man, and kind of resigned to everything that is happening. I mean, the thing when he's pretending that he's telling Ray to go to the pub, even though he's already gone to the pub, but he doesn't want to tell Harry that he wasn't waiting for his call. It is just the most delightful. He's
going to the bowling alley.
He's going to
the
bowling alley.
Yeah, bowling alleys in Bruges.
And just some sighing as he walks to the door, opens it, then closes it, and just to pretending this. Oh,
did you check outside? Is he outside the door? Are you listening again?
It's absolutely, yeah, it is so good. And then again, Ralph Fiennes with a nose, but there's a way he holds his face while he's jutting his chin out like he's always on the verge of anger, which he is.
Oh yeah, very high strung.
Very high strung, and just his Cockney accent, which is perfect because Ralph Fiennes does not have a natural Cockney accent. But he's got that at least London criminal kind of thing about him, and everything is just works so perfectly well. So when you're watching it, you can tell this thing has been in the works for a while and it's up to its nice boil and everything's kind of just clicking. Or it looks like that at the movie. I mean, who knows what happens on, you know, thing. And but this is, as I said, I always thought this was the movie that broke out Colin Farrell. I think this movie is way, I used to think this movie was way older than it used to be because it's such this fresh, hungry performance by Colin Farrell. And it wasn't. He had a whole 10-year career behind him. It's just this is one where he decided to go to rehab, go straight and go kind of start making movies again. But he wanted to make an indie and he got this movie and it feels like a fresh performance.
Yeah, and I honestly think he's more like himself.
Yeah,
to be honest. I mean, obviously I obviously don't know the guy, and but I definitely feel like he's being an actor more so in those blockbuster films that he's been in, where I feel like in this time he's having more fun with it because he's actually able to relax a little bit and build that rapport with people, and also like you know it's somebody. I mean, he's from this country, so
yes,
like, you know, he I feel like he has a comfortability to it that I think it just comes off naturally that way, and so I think that's something that I find very fresh.
Yeah, because he's able to have his Irish accent and able to lean into his very Irish accent, and you're right, it just kind of feels very very natural when every single time, and this is in Fright Night as well, but he's being very inhuman in Fright Night, but he's having to do the accent, he's being a bit more actory, and here he's just, you feel like he's goofing off a little bit, and it's fun to watch because watching a Colin Farrell performance isn't usually that relaxing because you can feel that he's doing all these kind of things, especially with his eyebrows, but this is kind of what he probably does with his eyebrows every day, and I like it.
Me too.
Anything else you want to say about this glorious, glorious movie?
I mean, I could talk about it to death. But yeah, this is just one of those movies that I if anyone who's listening, if you haven't seen this movie, and we kind of talked it, you know, a lot about it, so I'm sure there's some things that might not be a surprise to you, but I would highly, highly recommend this movie. Just obviously, as we warned you, there is some language, but if you can kind of just see it as a part of the setting and also a part of what's going on in the film, like it just kind of comes off naturally. At least that's how I see it. But I think you'll have a good time.
No, I agree with that. I mean, these are characters who are homophobic, racist, and everything in between, but it's kind of who the characters are, not I think who everything else is around it is. And I think you very much get the sense of like, I love how characters repeat jokes from other characters. So it again gives them the history of how they know each other and everything like that. And we haven't completely spoiled the ending, which is glorious. I didn't ruin one thing, but there's a few things that happen afterward that I think is just absolutely amazing, and I would recommend seeing this movie because just the dialogue and the acting and the setting is just all perfect, and you're just, yeah, I start giggling from the get-go and laugh most of the way since, and it does creep in under your skin for a while, and then you realize you've always watched this movie. It's a very weird feeling.
Yeah, it is. And I've mentioned, it's a rewatchable movie too.
Oh,
it's, yeah. That's one of those things that you'll probably find something different each time you watch it. So.
Oh, you will. You will absolutely get to the ending and then realize you could just go right back to the beginning and watch it again and again and again, because it's purgatory, but it's quite a nice purgatory, this one, I'll have to say.
What a nice purgatory. That's a tagline for it. We got to sell it that way.
Look, if I have to spend purgatory in Bruges, I wouldn't be complaining that much. For a while, at least, anyway.
Yeah, until you saw all the sights. And.
Yeah, again and again. Going to that same pub every night might be a bit too much, but for a little while, it'd be lovely.
Yeah, they would. And hopefully there would be more productions being shot there, right?
Yeah, hopefully. I know tourism has definitely gone up, because the whole joke is that no one knows where this town is. And now I think because of this movie, everyone knows where Bruges is.
Everyone knows what it is, yeah.
In fact, I call it In Bruges, not just Bruges.
Yeah, it's like, I'm going to Bruges, like In Bruges.
In Bruges.
Yeah.
I am in Bruges, as I've had so many postcards like, yes, that joke. I'm jealous. I'm going to go to Bruges. I'm going to be in Bruges.
Yeah, I have not been to Europe yet. I was actually supposed to be in England and also Paris in France last year, but obviously COVID stopped that. So one of the things that I definitely have on my bucket list is to go here.
Oh, no, I went 20 years ago when I was in my early 20s, as you do. Well, yeah, a lot of people do. And I was also meant to go Germany and Poland last year. But of course, COVID put a stop to that. So, well, again, definitely on my bucket list. And I might have to add Bruges to that list because it's Bruges.
it's a fucking fairy tale.
It's a fucking fairy tale. Before we go, Nathan, please plug away. Tell people where they can find your good work.
Yeah, you can find me on YouTube, like we talked about earlier. If you want to just type in Nathan Jones or follow the link that Lindsay has, or you can type in Nathan Jones movie review. I'm not the Australian wrestler that a lot of people think that name suggests, who's been in Mortal Kombat, Troy, Mad Max Fury Road. Mm. I've been in a lot of movies, you know.
You're a busy man.
I am, and I used to be in the WWE. But anyway, that was my past life. Also armed robbery, but we don't talk about that one. But anyway, you can find me there on YouTube. I'm also on Twitter. I'm trying to remember my tagline on Twitter, so I'm looking at it right now. It is at Nathan B. Jones 23. And I'm on there occasionally. I don't post too much on there, but I'm there as well.
No, excellent. I'd definitely recommend the YouTube channel, because it is just a really diverse look at movies, physical media, and just the people that you sort of also get on there as well. So like when you're going Criterion shopping in Kansas City and all that kind of thing, it's never the same thing, which I really, really appreciate.
Yeah, I try to switch it up, because the life's interesting, and why not make it interesting on the channel too?
Exactly. Or when you just have Chris on and you're just leaning against the DVD wall like nothing else matters, and I'm just like, oh yes, I see the Chris influence. Yes, yes, there it is.
Chris keeps me young.
Let's
just say that. I'm only slightly older than him, but there's so much differences. There's so much there. So.
Believe me, I know. Well, I consider Chris a friend as well, but he's a special one, and we love him.
I just love his hot takes.
Oh my God, his hot takes initially, are the best.
Initially, I always got a little upset about him. I'm like, what the hell are you talking about, dude? Now I just know he's just poking the bear. So I'm just like, you know what? Like, I'm just going to roll with it, and that's what I do.
It's Chris, and we love him. And just he's the agent of chaos, and the hot take, and the salty YouTube channel. So I'm guessing I'm giving Chris a plug. So yes, definitely follow him as well.
Go follow Inside the Sequel.
Yes, Inside the Sequel.
Give it a thumbs down. Give it a thumbs down.
Yes.
Unsubscribe if you're subscribed to him already. Just leave him alone. Let him fall over to obscurity. You heard it here first.
And with that, thank you so much for coming onto the show. This has been an absolute blast. As I said, I've been watching your YouTube channel for a while, so to have you on Shock and Awe was great.
Well, I want to say thank you so much, because I've been, you know, ever since my friends, like I mentioned, Chris and Daniel, you know, have done their podcast worlds, I've been introduced to so many different podcasts, including Shock and Awe, and I really enjoy it, and I'm glad that I was able to join along for two lovely eyebrow raising films.
These are definitely eyebrow raising films, and it has been a pleasure to absolutely wax lyrical about them. Thank you so much for coming on. If you want to follow Shock and Awe, it's Shock and Awe 1 on both Twitter and Instagram. If you want to follow me, it's just Reading Geek on Twitter. Also Letterboxd. I spend way too much time online. And if you want to rate and review the show, that would be great. Apparently it helps. And yeah, we will be back next time with another double feature. All right, cool. Thanks, guys. Bye.